We are back. I am Paula Gordon. Bill Russell and I are with Professor Alan Guth. We are at MIT, and we're talking about the biggest of the big stuff, but we're also talking about the smallest of the big stuff, aren't we?
That's right. There's a very interesting link between particle physics and cosmology.
That's not obvious.
Right. What makes the link is the fact that the early universe was so hot. That means that the matter was moving around, the particles were moving around with such high energies that the only real handle we have on studying those energies is through particle physics.
So you can only look at the big stuff through the little stuff?
That's right. Well, particle accelerators can reach energies which are much, much hotter in equivalent temperature than any device that actually creates a hot mass of matter. Genuine furnaces, the kind of things people use for nuclear fusion, can, for example, simulate the conditions in the universe back to maybe 5 or 10 seconds after the Big Bang. Particle accelerators can essentially reproduce the conditions going all the way back to maybe 10 to the minus 12 seconds after the Big Bang. So it really is particle physics that gives us our handle on how matter might behave at such extraordinarily high energies and densities.
What you're describing is a very short time interval. 10 to the minus 22nd seconds is, you know, it's faster than a snap of your hand.
That's right. Faster than a speeding bullet.
And for those of us living on what we view as a flat Earth, that is to say in local space and time, that would almost tend towards insignificance were it not for the kinds of massive events. Massive is the wrong word. Help me. But the
really, really big, massive.
Well, but also the definitive. I mean, essentially, the universe we inhabit was defined in something less than 10 to the minus 22nd seconds, and everything that we're experiencing now is directly traceable to that very, 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 very many zeros time frame.
That's right. And it does involve extrapolation of everything that we know. So there's a chance that these extrapolations don't work.
It does or does not?
It does. It definitely does. Now, I might say that particle physics is always dealing with times as short as, say, 10 to the minus 23 seconds, which sounds ridiculously short. Those times we now are very confident that we understand, because we really can do experiments involving elementary particles that directly test the behavior of those particles on timescales as short as, say, 10 to the minus 23 seconds.
That's why people come to MIT, is to learn how to think in time intervals of 10 to the minus 23
seconds. That's right. Well, that's right. It takes a while before you get used to those things.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah.
Once you get used to it, then it seems kind of commonplace. I mean, what seems normal is what you hear other people talk about. And if you hear other people talk about something enough, it gets to sound normal.
Well, that's really true, isn't it?
Weird.
It is. Some of this is what are your shared premises?
Absolutely.
And it goes back. I think. I mean, I'm fascinated by what happened almost 20 years ago. I mean, this. I hesitate to say explosion in knowledge of cosmology, but it appears that there was a coalescing of people and theory and communication and the ability to test hypotheses and the ability to form hypotheses. How did that all come together? And you were obviously in a position to be able to pull together the pieces of many pieces of that.
Well, I think most of the impetus for the wave of cosmology that I've been involved in has come with particle physics as its immediate source, although it's certainly true that everything we do owes a tremendous debt to people who worked on cosmology previously as well, which is an essential background to make sense out of anything that we've been doing. The big impetus that I think happened just when I got into cosmology around 1979 was the advent of what in particle theory are called grand unified theories.
And that is a plural.
Well, yes, because it really is a class of theories. We certainly don't know which of them are correct, if any. Inflationary theory, by the way, could also be considered plural. There really are a wide variety of inflationary theories, all of which are based on the same core idea, but there are many different ways of implementing it and varying it.
So these grand unifying theories were coming together as you were coming of age as a young physicist?
That's right. Grand unified theories were first proposed in 1974, but they didn't really catch on until pretty near 1980. What made them so believable was the tremendous success that particle theory had enjoyed up until that time. By the time grand unified theories were invented, particle theorists really had control over, there's understanding over the way elementary particles behaved in essentially every experiment that could be done. And that's still true today, even though we can do more experiments now. Today, really, everything that we can do still fits with what's called the standard model of particle physics.
When you talk about grand unified theory, you're talking about physics, bringing all of physics together in one theory that both explains and predicts everything we experience, with the exception of gravity, or including gravity, or what?
With the exception of gravity. Now, it's a matter of terminology. People certainly are trying to develop theories that include gravity. It's not that physics ignores gravity. But the phrase grand unified theory, which is what I'm talking about, refers to a class of theories which, in fact, leave gravity out. That may sound very strange to a lot of people, since gravity is such an evident feature in our everyday lives. What makes that plausible is a feature of gravity that I think most people don't realize, which is that gravity is actually extraordinarily weak on the scale of elementary particles. Gravity is very noticeable to us because of two features that it has, and it's the only force that has both of these features. It's a long-range force, and it's always attractive, so it adds up. So what we feel when we try to jump is the attraction of this entire planet Earth to all the atoms in our body. On the other hand, if you try to look for the gravitational force between two elementary particles, it's absolutely impossible to detect. To this date, nobody has ever detected the gravitational interaction of two elementary particles. While we see their electromagnetic interactions, their strong interactions, and what we call their weak interactions, very easily, they're much, much, much stronger. So for that reason, it's possible to, in a sensible way, leave gravity out for the time being and study the effect of the other three primary forces of nature.
And you should name those for us, please.
I was about to.
Oh, good.
Strong interactions, not a very original name, that refers to the interactions between quarks, which hold them together to make up protons and neutrons.
And those are Q-U-A-R-K-S's, quarks.
That's right. Q-U-A-R-K-S, quark, right, invented by Mary Gell-Mann, who also chose the name. And the residual effects of these strong interactions are also what hold protons and neutrons together inside the nucleus of an atom and are responsible for things like the power of nuclear fusion. Next on the list, coming down in strength, are the electromagnetic interactions, which most people, everybody's familiar with. That's how people are hearing our voices right now, through radio waves or through electric signals over the internet. And then next on the list is something which is, again, somewhat obscure, something called the weak interactions. The weak interactions are responsible for some of the things that atomic nuclei do. In particular, some of the decays, what are called beta decays, are entirely controlled by the weak interactions. And then finally, much, much weaker than all of those, is gravity at the very bottom of the list.
One of the dozens of things that I just found charming, and I'm not talking about quarks, in what you're talking about in your spectacular book, The Inflationary Universe, is how you tell me that observation and theory, that reality and speculation really are wedded, and that each enriches the other. As you sit here telling me about the strong and the weak force and the electromagnetic force, the things that are just completely abstract to me, the ability to plug into the stuff that you're talking about is real, and we can it feeds each other, and we learn from it, and it doesn't learn from us. Isn't this just a spectacular playground for you guys?
Well, it is. It's tons of fun. And actually, you're mentioning that, I don't know, someone encourages me to think about an old story. I really got excited about physics the first time when I was in high school. A friend of mine was doing a physics project, which consisted merely of taking a yardstick and punching a hole in it in different places and pivoting it about that hole and letting it rock back and forth and just measuring the period and how it depends on where you put the hole. And at this time, I was just learning physics, and I had just acquired enough knowledge to be able to go home and figure out what the answer should be. So I did that and came in the next day with an equation, and we started plugging numbers into the equation and comparing with my friend's data, and it worked.
Whoa,
it really blew my mind to think that you could actually go home and do a calculation and find out how fast a pendulum would go back and forth.
This goes to something.
It was really exciting, and now it's still the same thing. Now it's sort of more like the real world, and we're trying to calculate things like the statistical properties of the non-uniformities of the cosmic background radiation and things like that. And sometimes it works, and it's absolutely fantastic.
We'll probably want to come back to this, but you mentioned early on in your book your fascination, I think, and this goes to the story you just told, with the role of mathematics. Why does math work?
We're going to do that when we come back. This is Alan Guth. We are at MIT, and we are pleased to be in his office. The occasional sounds you hear are all progress. I'm sure of it. This is the Paula Gordon Show. Please stay with us.